And we'll be returning to Mike Zint in a moment. But first, a musical break from a guy I have never played before on free radio, but probably be quickly familiar to all of you old timers and probably many of you new timers.
As a snow flies, when a cold and gray Chicago morning, a poor little baby child is born in the ghetto. And his mama cries. But if there's one thing that she don't need, it's another hungry mouth to feed in the ghetto. People, don't you understand that child needs heaven? You're gonna be an angry young man someday. And take a look at you and me, I'll be too blind to see. Do we simply turn our heads and look the other way? Will the world turn? Little boy with the runny nose plays in the street as a cold wind blows in the ghetto. And his hunger burns. So he starts to roam the streets at night, and he learns how to steal, and he learns how to fight in the ghetto. Then one night in desperation, the young man breaks away. He buys a gun, he steals a car, he tries to run, but he don't get far, and his mama cries. As a crowd gathers round, an angry young man face down in the street with a gun in his hand in the ghetto. And as the young man dies, on a cold and gray Chicago morning, baby child is born in the ghetto, and his mama cries.
And that was In the Ghetto, a song written by Mac Davis, who, according to the liner notes, entered the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2006, where he explained it was a simple matter of growing up with a little boy whose father worked with my father. He lived in a part of town that was a dirt street ghetto. I grew up in Lubbock, Texas, and it was a ghetto in every sense of the word, but we didn't use that word back then. I was trying to come up with a song called The Vicious Circle. How a child is born, he has no father, and the same thing happens. The word ghetto became popular in the late 60s to describe the poor parts of town. A friend of mine, Freddie Weller, used to play guitar for Paul Revere and the Raiders, showed me lick on the guitar one day. I went home and fiddled with it. I wrote the song and called him at 4 in the morning and sang it to him. He knew I'd written a hit with his lick, but that's the way it goes. And at which point, Elvis, that's Elvis Presley, of course, who sang the song, was hesitant to do In the Ghetto. Colonel Parker had always drilled into his head, don't do message songs. If you do a message song, it's just like taking a political side. Whatever side you're going to take is going to offend the others. I was in the control room after Elvis, and the musicians had been working on In the Ghetto a little bit. He said, look, I don't think I should do this song. I said, Elvis, if you're ever going to do a song like this, this is the one. He looked over at Chips, and Chips said, this is a hit record, but I'll tell you what, if you don't want it, can I have the song? Elvis didn't blink. He said, no, I'm going to do it. Of course, I play almost exclusively so-called message songs, and as one of Dick Nixon's, that's our former president, I am not a crook, Dick Nixon, who now looks, of course, brilliant compared to Bush and Trump, and for that matter, Obama. Well, I don't know about that, but they all look pretty bad. But I've never been a big fan of Elvis's, both because of the music situation and because of his political bent. But got to hear one of his songs on this show, amazingly enough. The story from the Friday, March 1st San Francisco Chronicle. Slain man's family files claim against Vallejo police. I thought of calling actually the attorney on this issue, John Burris, who I met casually at an ACLU shindig here in Santa Cruz, where the wards were presented, one of them to another person who I interviewed and will be here on the show soon, meaning like in a few minutes, Cynthia Berger. But I haven't done that yet. But here's what Gwendolyn Wu writes. The family of Willie McCoy filed a claim Thursday against the city of Vallejo, alleging the police department, quote, bungled from start to finish the response that led to the 21-year-old's shooting death. Civil rights attorney John Burris, who represents McCoy's family, stood with more than 40 of the man's relatives, friends, and supporters Thursday in front of City Hall to announce the claim. And, of course, that's one of the reasons I like somebody like Burris as a matter of principle, because he's not simply a lawyer who's cashing in on these situations, although I presume he also is cashing in. However, he's pushing the issue of police abuse in a city where it's not just this particular client whose concerns are the community's concerns, or whose relatives' concerns are the community's concerns. Because I have these concerns about Santa Cruz, not so much recent shootings by police, but behaviors that have led to shootings in the past, such as the killing of Happy John Dine and others, but behavior that essentially insulates the police department and apologizes for, I should say, excuses away its behaviors around use of force, conceals its records from the community, and puts it in a special privileged position above the community, which is unhealthy for both the police department and for the community. But again, continuing with this article. Burris also announced a second claim on behalf of Adrian Burrell, a Marine veteran who accused a Vallejo officer of assaulting him this year because he was filming his cousin being detained. The complaints accuse Vallejo police of wrongfully killing McCoy and assaulting and falsely detaining Burrell, respectively. McCoy was shot several times while sitting in his car February 9th in a Taco Bell drive-through lane. Vallejo police said he was slumped over and unconscious in a car and had a handgun on his lap. As six officers moved around his car, McCoy allegedly woke up and moved suddenly, leading police to open fire. Burris said McCoy was shot 25 times, and he suggested the use of force was excessive and easily avoidable. They had time, the boy was asleep, and they didn't have to rush the car, Burris said. McCoy's family has been highly critical of the police department's response, and the incident has been used as a rallying cry for reform. What you do to one of us, you do to us all, said David Harrison, adding that he is a cousin of not only McCoy, but also of Burrell. Simone Richard, McCoy's sister, stood with a sign in her brother's memory and blasted the police officer's actions. Y'all just never gave him a chance, and that's just not fair, she said, calling her brother's death an execution. The families of Angel Ramos and Ronell Foster, who were fatally shot by Vallejo police officers in 2017 and 2018, respectively, were also in attendance Thursday. I relive this every day like a nightmare, said Paula McGowan, Foster's mother. It's like I have a life sentence of pain. She wore a white sweatshirt spray painted with black and blue paint to name the people killed by police. Burris represents the families of Ramos and Foster, the latter of whom was killed by a Vallejo officer also involved in McCoy's death. Burris said Vallejo police still have not released body camera footage from multiple police shootings. The family suffers as a consequence of not knowing what happened, Burris said. The second claim announced Thursday accuses the family of unlawfully detaining Burrell when a Vallejo police officer allegedly slammed him against his house and handcuffed him. Cell phone footage from the January 22nd incident shows Officer David McLaughlin speaking to Burrell's cousin, Michael Walton, after Walton parked his motorcycle in Burrell's driveway. McLaughlin allegedly believed that Walton was a motorcyclist who was seen speeding earlier that morning. The officer told Burrell to retreat inside his home, but after Burrell refused, McLaughlin handcuffed him and accused him of resisting. The two were both let go after Burrell asked McLaughlin to rearrange his cuffs because of an injury he sustained in the Marine Corps. And that's the story. Slain man's family set to sue Vallejo police, by Gwendolyn Wu, San Francisco Chronicle, Friday, March 1st, 2019. And after that, it's back to Mike Zint in Berkeley on March 2nd, 2019.
Now, about a year ago, a UN rapporteur came down. You and I and others gathered at the old Berkeley City Hall, and, you know, we got to tell tales of woe and so forth. Did anything ever come of that?
No, of course not. The thing is, when she showed up in Berkeley, there were, there was Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Oakland as well. And I'm sitting here in Berkeley, and at that point in time, I had a camp at City Hall, a camp at Here There, and a camp at Aquatic Park. Okay, and I'm going, you know, do I want to keep the peace or do I want to rock the boat? So what I did was I asked, her name is Leilani, I asked her not to go in the papers like she did with Oakland, San Francisco, and Oakland, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. I asked her not to do that because I didn't want to create animosity between us and the city, and I didn't want the world to think that Berkeley was in even the same league of abuse as those other cities. Berkeley doesn't do what those other cities do. Berkeley does other things. You know, their cops don't go around and just, you know, harass the hell out of homeless people. They don't do that. I've actually seen Berkeley police helping homeless people. But they do follow orders from the city manager's office, and the city manager's position is, you know, harass the homeless or do things that cause the homeless pain and suffering. I don't have constant raids going on. I don't have sweeps like San Francisco's doing. You know, it's just downright abusive what these other cities are doing. It's literal torture. And no, Berkeley doesn't do that. And I also didn't want to cause the city to get mad. You know, the city hall encampment was under fire at that point, literally, because there had been a fire. And then 2 weeks after Leilani left, they did raid because of a fire. You know, and these were fires that were started by other people, not the homeless, and that's what's funny. Our group did not start the fires, was not even involved in that, but we took the blame. And then they did raid Aquatic Park. So we got reduced from three camps down to one. I think they're going to have a problem raiding the last one if they try, because that's the one that's got the most support. It's got the entire South Berkeley community supports it. And then, you know, all over the area, people, because the camp's over 2 years old, people are aware that it's a good camp that is actually saving lives.
Now, what about, I know this hasn't been your main focus of interest, but we've had recent reports about People's Park being denuded of trees and headed for the scrap heap or the redevelopment heap.
Yeah, we were there. We were there.
Well, tell me about it. Give me an update. What's going on there?
Yeah, there's a couple of our more important members, one of our founding members, James Cartmill, First Camp for the Homeless, and Michelle Lott, who was instrumental in helping me with Liberty City, and she helped maintain the post office occupation while I was over at Liberty City. So these two people, and then Tannis, which is her son, and a few others that we've met along the way, they go into the park and they start an occupation. Now, the thing about James is he's not going to be diplomatic, and he's not going to be politically correct. He's going to go out there and he's going to instigate and he's going to start shit. And that's what he did. And they ended up paying the price. But they did get a lot of attention. They went in to protect the trees. They tried to do citizens' arrests on the cops, which I always enjoy. I think that's the funniest thing because, you know, it never works. But it makes the cops go, what the hell are you doing? You know, you can't do this. Well, yes, we can, officer. We can arrest you. You know, so that's the type of stuff. And it caused the UC Berkeley cops to get a little irritated. So when they did finally raid the encampment, they brought in 150 cops on six homeless people. And that's the type of stuff that was needed to actually get the attention on the issue. Now, there was never any hope that this occupation was going to do anything but get raided. But the fact that my friends went in there and they put it all on the line, and they lost everything they owned doing this, but they put it on the line, and they made a statement, and then after after all of this happens, and this is still an ongoing situation, they marched from, I believe, People's Park to the university, and as they were marching, somebody drove into their protest and ran over a protester's bike. And then, when the protesters responded with anger and went after the car, he decides that it's okay to drive down a one-way road until he couldn't drive. And then he jumps on the sidewalk, drives down the sidewalk, and runs over a homeless man's foot who was asleep on the sidewalk. And off he goes. He goes home.
What was the outcome of that? I remember reading about it, I guess, 3 or 4 weeks ago, right?
Yeah, the outcome is there is no outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we don't know. This is a guy, you know, we've got different ages, between 18 and 21, but adult. Okay, and when the cops get to his house, him and his dad are sitting there going, oh, well, we were just about ready to come to the police department to fill out a report.
Mm-hmm.
Really? 2 days later? Really? Oh, no. So we want to know who dad is. Dad is obviously powerful and influential. If his son can get away with hitting a homeless man and driving away, you know, then there's definitely no law and order at all. He drove down a sidewalk. Nothing. He ran into a protest and ran over a bike, and some of it got caught on video. Him running over the homeless man's foot and driving down the sidewalk was caught on video. Nothing. Total silence on the issue. Okay. Oh, we're going to forward the information for the DA to charge. Oh, I doubt that even happened. It's been total silence ever since then.
Did the campers or protesters or tree sitters return to People's Park?
Not to my knowledge. Some of them are in and out, but Cartmill, Michelle, and Tannis, they have to recover from what happened. I mean, they went to jail. But losing their gear is something that they're still trying to recover from, and they are homeless. So they have to try to figure out how to survive as well as recover their gear, and they have to do it while they're being harassed by the cops.
Are there any events planned for People's Park that we should know about here?
Not that I know of. I'm kind of out of the People's Park fight. You know, I'm not involved because I'm too far away. I need to be at the park. And my opinion, that's all it is an opinion, is this fight needed to start 3 or 4 years ago. They needed to work on changing the perception of what the park really is. And that never happened. So the community is against the park, and they need the community to support the park. You know, my personal feeling is they need to leave the park alone. It's a piece of history. It is a huge piece of history that's known around the world. And to plow it under, to put up housing for students that aren't even supposed to be there, when they've got, I think, 7 other locations to put housing. No, it's about destroying the park. It's about UC Berkeley sticking it to the people of Berkeley. And after talking to my friends who live in that neighborhood, the infrastructure can't support the building. There's no parking for who lives there now. What are they going to do with a couple hundred more vehicles? You know, it's about getting rid of the park. It's not about thinking this through and making a commitment to the city. You know, they've got 8,000 extra students. So, and that's a burden that the city of Berkeley has to foot, not the Berkeley's not doing shit for the city.
Can you hold for a second? Go ahead.
I forgot what I was talking about.
I did too, but I think we've covered a lot of stuff here. I guess I can ask in broader questions. Is there much ferment around other issues in Berkeley, like, I don't know, an invasion of Venezuela or, I don't know, you know.
I've been following the Venezuela thing, and, you know, I don't believe anything our government says. I'm sorry.
Our government? I didn't know where we had a government, actually. They have a government.
Well, we got Trump.
They got Trump.
We got Trump. Yeah, that's all we need, man. Trump is everything.
Yeah, they got Trump, and they got Obama, and they've got, yeah. Well, all right. Well, that's, why don't we leave it there, then? We've covered some stuff, so anything you want to conclude with?
I got a lot of things to say, but the thing is, I don't see any hope right now that any of this is actually changing. You know, I was hopeful when the Ninth Circuit ruling came, and our class action lawsuit is still going on. So
you want to give an update on that, or?
I don't have one. Just this. See, I was interviewed by KPFA. KPIX a couple of weeks ago, and they went and they interviewed Dan Siegel also. And they told me it had to do with the Lake Merritt raids that they were conducting. And they told me originally the story would be on Thursday. Then they said, no, it got bumped to Friday, so I waited for Friday. They said, oh, well, it's been put off until Monday or Tuesday. And I go and I check Monday and Tuesday, and it never made it on.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm beginning to wonder, you know, why would they send a TV crew out to my house and then a TV crew to my lawyer's office if they weren't going to actually do a story on us?
Now, this is about the abrogation of First Amendment rights around a raid on first that came for the homeless protest encampment about, what, 2 years ago now?
Yeah, the poor tour started in October of 2016 and ended in January of 2017. And during those 3 months, we were raided at least 17 times. It could have been as high as 21, but it really depends on how you know, interpret what a raid is. You know, some of those were just police saying you can't set up here. But no, the full-scale raids were 17. And it's I don't know if it's as much First Amendment as it is Fourth Amendment. The thing is, they took our gear and threw it away.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing that, out of everything that happened through the port tour, that's the thing that really pissed off most people. They were blatantly destroying gear. And when they stole everything I owned and left me, you know, I didn't even have shoes or a jacket or anything like that. They kicked me out of Santa Rita with nothing, okay? So that's where this lawsuit comes from. And even though it's not going to cover the entire Ninth Circuit, it is Ninth Circuit for Berkeley, and it can be used as a stepping stone for other locations to file additional lawsuits. And that is forward progress if we win the case, which, of course, you know, there's never a guarantee we're going to win any case.
Next court date is?
I have no idea.
I got
you. I send information. I believe the next one is coming up in 2 weeks. I saw a post, from somebody a couple of weeks ago from a Ninth Circuit calendar.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it is coming up. But, you know, I contact Emily, who is the attorney who's been working with the homeless in the area for the last, since Liberty City. That's where we first met her. She showed up out of nowhere and saved our ass.
Emily
Rose Johns from Siegel and Yee. And I think Brun, I think they were. Yeah, they added another lawyer, but it was Siegel and Yee when we started with them. So we've got actually a really well-known attorney working with us, and coincidentally, he's the guy who started the riot at People's Park by saying, hey, let's go to the...
I remember, yeah. I mean, I wasn't there, but I remember reading about it.
Yeah, so he's our lawyer, and I'm loving this. You know, I think this is one of the greatest things that we have. This guy and his law firm stepped up to do this for free.
Mm-hmm.
Or, well, we haven't had to pay, I should say. It may not be free. You know, there may be money. I signed a contract, you know, for them to, if we get monetary damages, they'll get paid. But, you know, I told them this isn't about the money, at least to me. This is about we need to fight back. We need to lay the groundwork for others to fight back.
And where can people find more information about this lawsuit in terms of upcoming court dates, updates, the history?
Okay, you can go to the calendar, the Ninth Circuit San Francisco calendar has it on there. Judge Alsup is our judge, ALSUP. And there is also Courthouse News, the publication. They cover our court case, and they have updates. They update as the trial is taking place. Every day we go to court, they update their publication. So that's how I've been keeping up with things.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't seen an update in about 4 months.
And so also First That Came for the Homeless might, on his Facebook page, have an update?
No, I'm the one who does the Facebook page.
Well, get busy there, Mike, for heaven's sake.
I write my attorney, and, you know, she doesn't really respond.
I see.
You know, she's busy.
Uh-huh.
The thing is, I don't want to bug her because I know that she's buried. You know, she's got our lawsuit. There's actually 3 lawsuits going on from us, including personal injury lawsuit that she's handling from the 3 women that got beat up. But there's also, she was touring with the Oakland situation, and she's trying to work with Oakland as well. So I have no idea how many cases she's working, but I know she's extremely busy. And I don't really care about an update as much as I care that she continues working. I'm not going to bug her. You know, if something big develops, I know they'll contact me. You know, and if I really get pushed into it, I'll call Dan, and I'll ask Dan what's up.
Well, I know that in Santa Cruz, we had an attorney, Anthony Prince, who's been representing clients in Marysville and Salinas, and also working on organizing a thing called the Union of the Homeless statewide.
I know. I've talked to him.
Yeah, then you know you're familiar with him. He's coming down here next Wednesday to continue interviewing people and actually encouraging people to file pro bono lawsuits themselves to deal with that very issue you talk about, which is, you know, the seizure of their property. And that, of course, it would probably be in, I would assume it's small claims court, but maybe it's also for class action. So there is some kind of, he's using it not as an attempt to get legal redress as any sort of magic, you know, a wand or silver bullet, but as a way of educating and activating and empowering folks, which, I don't know, if any, it's a little questionable whether courts are anything you should encourage people to turn to as empowering, because it's, you know, pretty rigged game.
Right. We don't get empowered by calling the court.
No, I understand.
You know, the truth is, when you're homeless and you have to go to court to do a fight, it's impossible. You can't just function like a house person, have an appointment book, because necessities of life pop up. Sometimes you just can't go to court. Sometimes, you know, you have to eat, or you don't have money to get there. You know, these are the types of things that happen to homeless people that make it very difficult to fight back. But when you have lawyers that are willing to step up and do all the legwork for you, that's when you can fight back. And if he wants to go do some legwork, yeah, you know, I'll help. I'll help in any way. But as far as becoming part of this homeless union, I don't know yet. You know, I've heard about the union. He talked to me about it a couple of years ago. And, I was in the position at that point that I could not think outside of Berkeley. You know, now that we have networked and we're in Oakland and we're in, you know, the other smaller cities in the area, we might be able to group up and do the homeless union. But what I'm seeing is each group that we've aligned with is so busy concentrating on their own issues that they don't really have time to group up and do a group fight. We did it once in October when they were getting ready to raid Lake Merritt the first time, and we mounted a successful defense using First They Came for the Homeless and the Bay Area Landless Coalition, which is the area that's like our, you know, our little homeless union that has failed. But we're working on it. We're working together, and that's the first step. But, you know, with Nita B. from Dignity Village and the Village of Open Feed the People, she's buried. You know, she's fighting the cops, and she's fighting the city, and she's fighting for a bunch of women and children, and she doesn't have time to come to Berkeley and fight for the RVs. The RV people, they didn't contact me, unfortunately, otherwise I would have tried to help them. So that kind of fell through. It's just we're not communicating, and we're not talking like we need to, and we're not committed to each other like we need to. And if I can't get that commitment from, you know, this area where we're only 10 miles apart, there's no way that our group or any of the homeless in this area are going to be able to commit to something in Salinas or something in Santa Cruz. You know, like, unfortunately, I would love that, but it's just not a reality.
And on that optimistic note, I want to thank you for, you know, talking with us and, you know, giving us your straight thoughts. And frankly, gloomy as the actual message may be, I think the spirit behind it is far from gloomy. So that's what encourages me.
As long as there is a court case out there, there is hope. That's how I feel.
Well, you have more faith in the courts than I do. That's for damn sure.
Well, I don't have faith in the courts. What I do have faith in is the public. I think the more the public sees the abuses and the more they realize that there is no solution being offered, there's just harassment, they're going to finally say, hey, stop. You know, or they're going to know somebody or one of their family members is going to be a victim of the police in the cities. And that's when, you know, the more victims that are out there, the more family members stand up and say, this is, you know, too much. You've got to stop doing this. That's when we're going to start seeing things change.
Right. But I think that's more due to the work that you and First They Came for the Homeless and similar groups have done with 17 separate acts of resistance, more than that, presence every day in the poor tour. That, you know, than any particular court case here, there, or anywhere, frankly.
It's the public that's keeping us going. It's not the court. It's not.
Yeah, but they're keeping you going because you get out there and start going.
They're keeping us going because we already did the fight.
Right.
They appreciated and they respected.
You had to get there to do it for them to even know you were out there. That's the point.
Yeah, we had to do this fight. We had to do the poor tour to get the support. And I did have an advantage over the average homeless group out there because I did Bpod. 17 months on the streets of Berkeley working with the homeless, feeding the homeless. I was a homeless man sitting on my ass literally for 17 months taking care of a bunch of people. And those are the people that remember me. And the people who supported the post office that didn't want Richard Blum to steal it from the city, those people are still working with me. And they saved the post office. That tells you how powerful this group is. Now, I didn't handle the court case side of it. I handled the occupation side of it. There were two different groups that did the post office. But both those groups respected what First They Came for the Homeless did, because we maintained a drug-free presence at the post office. We kept it clean, and we did a lot of things to do outreach, and we talked to a lot of people. And then we did save a couple of lives, too. You know, so this is where we started from. And that's what got us to the point we're at right now. I don't think I would have succeeded if I just did the poor tour without the post office occupation. We wouldn't have had the support necessary. We would have had a half a dozen advocates instead of 50 advocates.
And I think I'm going to leave it there. And thank you, Mike. Anything else?
Yeah. No. Thanks for giving me a call, Robert.
No, thanks for talking.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Have a good one.
And let's go musical now. And... let's go musical.
Last night I couldn't sleep. I got up and started walking down to the end of my street and on into town. Well, I had no one to meet and I had no taste for talking. Seems I'm talking my whole life. It's time I listen now. Well, I walk past the late night boys with their bottles in their doorways. And I walk past the businessmen sleeping like babies in their cars. And I thought to myself, oh son, you may be lost in more ways than one, but I've a feeling that it's more fun than knowing exactly where you are. Like a storm carried on the river, like a boat. Warm sunlight forming on my shoulders, 'cause it hit me with no warning, like a summer sky storming in my lungs. Ain't it funny how the kids walk by, they do anything to make themselves look older, while the women spend their money on anything that makes them look young. Till I
Mike Rosenberg from the album All the Little Lights, name of the group Passenger. And in case you're wondering what the lyrics were like, to the name of the song was Keep on Walking. Here they are. Well, last night I couldn't sleep. I got up and started walking down to the end of my street and on into town. Well, I had no one to meet, and I had no taste for walking. Seems I'm talking my whole life. It's time I listen now. When I walk past the late-night boys with their bottles in their doorways, and I walk past the businessmen sleeping like babies in their cars, and I thought to myself, oh, son, you may be lost in more ways than one, but I have a feeling that it's more fun than knowing exactly where you are. Like a stone carried on the river, like a boat sailing on the sea, well, I keep on walking, oh, I keep on walking, till I find that old love, or that old love comes to find me. Well, I walked into the morning and felt that warm sunlight forming on my shoulders, because it hit with no warning, like a summer and sky storming in my lungs. Ain't it funny how the kids walk by? They'll do anything to make themselves look older, while the women spend their money on anything that makes them look young. Like a stone carried on the river, like a boat sailing on the sea, oh, I keep on walking. I keep on walking till I find that old love, oh, that old love comes to find me. And there's another chorus of the same. A story from the second section of the Saturday's, that's yesterday's San Francisco Chronicle, on March 2nd. Sheriff's deputies cleared in Millbrae tasing death, by Ashley McBride and Gwendolyn Wu. This is another story by Gwendolyn Wu. The San Mateo County District Attorney's Office announced Friday it will not seek charges against the sheriff's deputies who tased an unarmed black man to death in October. The case, the county's third taser death in a year, has received widespread attention in the 5 months since Chinedu Okabe, 36, died after being approached, tased, and restrained by deputies while walking down El Camino Real in Millbrae. San Mateo County District Attorney Wagstaff determined that the deputy's use of force in tasing Okabe was reasonable after conducting interviews with deputies and witnesses, as well as reviewing the coroner's report and audio and video recordings of the incident. This is not a case where I am trying to put any blame on Mr. Okabe, Wagstaff said Friday. It was a tragic event, and I don't want to do anything to demonize these or Mr. Okabe in any manner. Okabe's family and their attorney, John Burris, criticized the district attorney's reasoning Friday and said they still intend to file a lawsuit. In November, the Okabe family was shown a 30-minute video of the incident, which they said proved deputies used excessive force. Friday's decision not to charge the officers only heightened their outrage. It's clear the district attorney doesn't intend for there to be any consequences at all, said Ebele Okabe, Chinedu Okabe's sister. We feel the district attorney is completely unwilling to protect citizens, and the sheriff is completely uninterested in ensuring police officers don't kill unarmed citizens. The district attorney's investigation revealed that Okabe's initial violation was jaywalking. He was running through traffic on October 3rd on the 1300 block of El Camino Real when a sheriff's deputy approached him, authorities said. Okabe allegedly refused to cooperate, and the deputy called for help. Three more deputies and a sergeant arrived, and Okabe was tased, causing the man to go into cardiac arrest. He was transported to Mills Peninsula Medical Center, where he was pronounced dead. Video footage of the encounter between Okabe and deputies, released Friday, shows a chaotic scene in which deputies tried to tase him seven times. Officials previously said deputies used a taser, said two deputies used a taser, but the investigation determined that only one deputy deployed the weapon. Unanimous opinion of my team was in accord with the expert we hired that under these circumstances it was a reasonable use of force, Wagstaff said. There's not an ethical prosecutor in this state that would have found a reason to charge the deputies. Video showed Deputy Joshua Wang initially trying to stop Okabe after he crosses El Camino against a red light. Wang then calls for more officers who approach Okabe on the sidewalk in front of a pizza parlor. After Okabe throws his arm over the head of one of the officers, two others rush him and tell him to stop resisting. Wagstaff said the officers could not physically restrain Okabe, so Wang resorted to his taser. Wagstaff called it an appropriate next step. "You're going to get tased. Get on the ground," Wang says in the video. As he's tased twice, Akobi heaves and screams, arms and legs flailing. "What I do?" he asks as the deputies command him to roll over onto his stomach. Video shows deputies trying to tase him four more times as he calls for help and attempts to stumble away. Wang then hits Akobi with a baton, and Akobi responds by striking Wang in the face. No footage from body-worn cameras or witness cell phones was provided from the point Akobi was restrained by deputies. As paramedics prep to take him to a hospital, Sergeant David Wedner tells the medics that Akobi has been tased several times and, quote, "he's probably got a lot of drugs on board, which explains why he was fighting so hard." No drugs or alcohol were found in Akobi's system, according to a toxicology report. An autopsy concluded that Akobi suffered from an enlarged heart and had no drugs or alcohol in his system. The cause of death was listed as cardiac arrest following physical exertion, physical restraint, and electromuscular disruption from the taser shocks. On Friday, Wagstaff said the coroner's office classified the manner of death as a homicide. "It's a homicide with apparently no one responsible," Eboli Akobi said. "Law enforcement was apparently not responsible for it." Both Wagstaff and Burris said the county law enforcement's use of tasers should be examined, and the family's attorney said the lawsuit he plans to file will force the sheriff's department to analyze its use of tasers and possibly lead to policy changes. Don't hold your breath, is my comment. The cops created the conflict, created a confrontation, and then fought their way out of it by beating this man up and ultimately tasing him and then finally killing him, Burris said. In a February 11th community forum called by San Mateo County supervisors, Sheriff Charles Bolanos defended the use of tasers as a less lethal option for officers when interacting with uncooperative suspects. Jaywalking suspects, yes, sorry. He added, "When officers deploy a taser, they aren't always aware of how many shocks the subject could be receiving. You're trying to subdue a subject who's resisting. There might be one or two more deputies, and there are highly stressful situations," Bolano said. "You really don't know, when you're in the midst of a situation, how many times you or someone else is activating the taser. It's not a serene situation." The district attorney's office declined to file charges in two other taser-related deaths last year in San Mateo County. Wagstaff's office cleared Redwood City police officers of wrongdoing in an August incident that killed 55-year-old Ramzi Said. Police responded to calls that a man was acting erratically and, similar to Chenadu Dukobi's case, had a history of mental illness. Saad went into cardiac arrest and later died after officers tased him and physically subdued him. In January 2018, 34-year-old Warren Ragudo of Daly City died after an officer tased him while two other officers pressed their weight upon him. Ashley McBride and Gwendolyn Wu in the story, "No Charges in Milbrae Tasing Death." That's yesterday's San Francisco Chronicle, the Bay Area section. Pretty nasty shit, I'm afraid. I, of course, don't have anything else other than that news story to go on. But the absence of the videos, the statements of the district attorney, the usual exculpatory cover stories of drugs, the whole notion of this incident, the number of police officers called to deal with a jaywalking incident, this attempt to show brutal force and authority, to enforce this kind of overweening authority in an unnecessarily brutal and ultimately fatal manner. Wearies me to even think of it. And I'd get angry if I weren't so tired. So, let's see if we can sort of swim through the weariness. And here's a bit of an interview from the Ross Camp last Wednesday. And just a sort of a reminder, I don't know if I mentioned it before, maybe it's not just a reminder, but an announcement, that Alicia Kuhl, who has been interviewed by, well, who I've interviewed for several times and, you know, almost regularly on this show, She's an RV dweller who lives with her children and her partner in a van and has confronted the police chief at a public press conference about his officer's tendency, in her view, to collude with local vigilantes who want to drive her out of the neighborhoods because they don't like her being there, falsely claiming she's been there for 72 hours straight when she's been there less than 24 hours. This is out on the Woodrow area near the Circle's churches. I think she's still out there. She's also helping to organize folks out at Ross and support the Ross camp. And she was mentioning she went to the Democratic Socialists meeting on, I guess it was on yesterday, on Saturday. And that she will be going out there, out to the Ross camp with those socialists on today, I guess, this Sunday, the 3rd. That they'll be, she'll be out there. I suspect, actually, by the time I played this, this is a little late in the game. It's going to be at 10 a.m. So I think I may have missed the boat in announcing it. But any time is an okay time to go out to the Ross camp and talk to folks out there if you're interested in what's going on out in Ross. I think in a week or so they've arranged to have Councilmember Glover go out there and chat with Ross people. That's the day before the March 12th city council meeting, which is coming up, which will be 3 days before what was the deadline for Ross on the 15th, but hopefully is no longer the case. Though, as has been mentioned several times, both in this broadcast and an earlier one, even though there was a 4-3 majority at the city council saying there is no Ross deadline anymore because there's inadequate shelter, nonetheless, they also unanimously passed a resolution that they're trying to meet the county's March 15th deadline. So it's this was done. Matthews, one of the reactionary and extremely right-wing council members on homeless matters, put this forward as a kind of, well, we want to cooperate with the county and assure them we're not going to duck out. So let's say we're still trying to meet the deadline, even though we're not trying to meet the deadline, or we've decided there is no deadline. If you can understand, if you believe the sheriffs and the city police are going to respect this kind of confusion and not substitute their own agenda, then they, well, I'm not obviously too confident about what's going to happen. So it's going to be a real issue. And also, of course, next on the 6th of March, there's going to be a meeting at the first at the Ross camp at 1:30, that's on Wednesday, and then at the Rio community room of the mobile home park, where Anthony Prince, the Palo Alto, I should say, Berkeley attorney, is going to be advising folks how to file their own class action lawsuit and how to stand up against police get out of here type statements, whether it's at the Ross camp or anywhere else, where a person is resting, sleeping, tenting tonight on the old concrete, given the fact that there's no shelter in town and there's a federal court decision in place called the Martin versus Boise decision, which says it's cruel and unusual punishment to attempt to criminalize homeless people when you've got no place to lock up those criminals in a nice little shelter that you can call adequate or even minimal. For that, on Wednesday, there will be a meeting of the Huff and Conscience in Action groups. Conscience in Action meets at the Sub Rosa at 11. Huff meets there at 12. Sub Rosa Cafe, right adjacent to the Bike Church, if you're a Bike Church fan or you know where that is. And it's also across from the Yan Flower Restaurant at 703 Pacific. And that's open to anybody who wants to come and is concerned about civil rights activities or lack of protections for folks on the street. So a lot of things continue to happen around the Ross camp and around folks in the city generally. There is no solid city council majority supporting homeless people. While it's true that Justin Cummings has joined the group, for the moment, the three council members who are pressing for very specific changes, reforms, and protections and such obvious things as opening the Loudoun Nelson bathrooms and the other bathrooms around the city. He has not supported that. He hasn't either, nor has he opposed it. It's all been, he's essentially supported delays in that whole thing, pushed by Matthews, Watkins, and Myers, the council minority, who are fundamentally the in league with the city manager and the city manager's deceptively fast-talking pseudo-housing presenters, Susie O'Hara and Tina Scholl, who are presenting alternatives for homeless shelter that don't really involve any meaningful, continuous, or secured shelter, to say nothing of housing, for the majority of homeless people in the city, and not even for the people in the Ross camp, but they claim they have going to be, they're presuming that they can cover, it's actually more of a cover-up than a cover, in my view, and it's quite typical of cities. So Santa Cruz, you might say, is just going along, get rid of all Negros. In other words, homeless people are treated like second-class citizens, the way blacks were and are in many cases throughout the country. And it's disgraceful, and that's why I'm glad to see community groups forming to fight this. Unfortunately, community groups are also forming to support this kind of clannish, you might say Ku Klux Klannish type activity, driving poor people away from town who are outside and homeless. So I've been promising to check in with Santa Cruz Tenants Association activist Cynthia Berger for quite a while now, and I actually caught up with her on Saturday. So I'm going to play some of that, and she gives us a sort of a variety of thoughts on some important issues around, well, the lack of rent control, the lack of just eviction protection in Santa Cruz, and the things that the Santa Cruz shitty council, as I like to call them, could do and should do. And she's, I think she's far more temperate in these matters than I am. I have, she believes it was a sensible thing for Justin Cummings to vote with the reactionary minority in killing rent control and just eviction protection in January when he helped to permanently table it over the votes of the three council members who supported it, Glover, Brown, and Crone. I thought that was bullshit, actually. And, of course, the reason that that happened supposedly was because, as Cynthia explained in one of her interviews that we had with her, she was afraid, or the groups that were supporting the rent control were afraid, that it would immediately be any attempt to establish the rent freeze and the just eviction protection, or to extend it as from what it was last year, would result in a recall action that would be successful because it would be supported by so much out-of-town money, and also the spurious claim that since Measure M was defeated, this was simply a runaround by the city council to ignore the voters. And while it is true that Measure M was defeated, it's not clear why it was defeated. In fact, some people just felt certain parts of it they didn't like, but other parts they did. And that meant that passing an equivalent measure on a local level is not necessarily something that would be the successful basis for a recall, in my view. That's something she and I disagree on. So, again, I've got no clear stats on this. I believe it's better to push ahead with these things. But I guess some feel that these four council members can do more good if they stay in place, even if they surrender the basic principles on which they were elected. I often feel that's a very dubious foundation on which to proceed. And so I don't like it. Anyway, let's hear what she has to say, and you can be the judge of what you think, as you are. Before we do that, as I think I mentioned before, and I've kind of spaced out on here, here's a little bit of the very end of the Ross camp visit that some of us did last Wednesday as, again, part of the series of continuing forums and attempts to encourage Ross folks to organize themselves and also present legal tools for anyone who's homeless or a homeless supporter to stand up against this drive-him-out-of-town mentality that has been kind of the holy writ in Santa Cruz, but covered up very nicely with all kinds of claims about helping the homeless and finding housing and having smart solutions and providing real assistance of a reasonable kind in a controlled environment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, none of which, of course, has anything to do with the most basic and elemental needs of the majority of the homeless population.
Still out here at the Ross Campground talking to
Daniel
and
Joseph.
Are you a man who lives here?
Off and on, yes.
What do you think?
Happy that it's here, considering that I don't get woken up by cops when I sleep here. Where if I normally sleep by myself, because there's a lot of other just things that come with being on the streets that I don't like to deal with and see every day.
But, and your pooch.
And my pooch, my dog, yes.
Her name is?
Nymeria. And she's amazing, husky.
Ooh, thank you.
And yeah, I'm very appreciative for it to being here and to being out of the rain and, you know, have a little shelter. We have ourselves we have a nice little spot, me and my friend.
How many, you and one other person?
Me and one other person.
In a tent or not?
No, we built a shed out of pallets and we got a corrugated roof and a door with a lock on it.
Oh my God.
It's hidden by tarps in the wind.
The actual campground.
Yeah, it's pallets, and then we
invited the police in.
No, we don't. We permitted ourselves to building it, though.
You gave yourself a permit. Yeah. Did you use the proper process?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And we got plyboards for walls and floors, drilled into pallets.
How long have you been there?
Roof. I just came back down from Mendo. I was up in Mendo for about 6 weeks. I've been here before that, and then been back here again.
What do you think of the Ross Camp?
I think it's a great place to be, considering that we're allowed to be here. Other than that, I think that it could use a lot of help, maybe even be taken down. If the rest of the fences in town could be taken down, there'd be no need for the Ross Camp, maybe. I don't know, it's pretty unsanitary, you know, it's hard to stay clean and to not get infections, and, well, like I said, you don't get woken up by the cops in the morning.
How long have you been here now?
In this camp, since they put it up, pretty much before they even put it up, where we have our little shed, was one of the first five tents that were up here before it was a camp. So, but yeah, I really do like what the idea of us being able to be somewhere. I mean, there's going to be some kind of solution as to, it's just such a small area for so many people. I think that's the problem. That's, yeah.
Well, the guy I was going to introduce, he was standing beside you a moment ago, Joe Schultz, the guy who brought the food. No, it's fine. He said to me before, this camp is not the problem, it's the solution in its own way.
Right. Yeah. Yes, this is it's definitely a solution.
And we've been talking with?
Daniel.
Anything else, Daniel?
No, you have a wonderful day.
You too.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, listen, do me a favor.
And now it's on to Cynthia Berger of the Santa Cruz Tenants Association.
So, I haven't been doing much, but
today is March 2nd. I'm on the line with tenant activist Cynthia Berger, who says she hasn't been doing much, but I don't know about that. Cynthia, what's been happening? Maybe not.
I guess I'm not ready for this. Maybe we'll talk before the interview.
That's okay. Look, spontaneous can sometimes be good. A couple interviews ago, we were talking about the deficiencies in the Oregon rent control, just eviction, whatever it is, ordinance was passed.
Okay, so, yeah, the problem with that is that it's like CPI plus, I think it's, I don't remember, but it's CPI plus like 5 or 7%, and that's like way beyond anyone's, normal people's capacity to pay. So I don't know why they're making a rent control law that's enshrining an exorbitant rent.
Now let me interrupt you, Cynthia. Because I don't quite know what you think. Clarify for our listeners what you mean by CPI and so forth.
So rent control laws are generally based on the Consumer satisfaction index is the average of all the costs, you know, in a person's life, and it comes out every year, and it's usually about supposedly it, not the consumer protection index, the consumer price index, and it usually goes up an average of a little below 3% a year, but some years it goes up 3.9%, some years it goes up 2.3%, so it's, you know, a little bit below usually 3% on average.
But it never really goes down much?
Well, it can go down, and what it is like, you know, when there's a depression, then prices have to go down because wages go down because there's not much work and there's a lot of competition for jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Hey. So basically things like cost of living adjustments are based on the consumer price index and how much your Social Security check or your government check, whatever, disability, Social Security goes up. It's kind of based on the consumer price index.
So what happened up in Oregon? What was the nature of this ordinance that was passed?
Well, I haven't studied it, but what I, you know, the thing that I didn't, that, you know, made me know that it was soft rent control is that it didn't enshrine just cause for eviction protections in its law, as far as I know, because, well, I would have heard about that, then it would have been a better law. But I don't have it in front of me, so probably better to interview me when I'm actually reading it.
Yeah, we can. We can,
I haven't looked at it for a while, but...
Yeah, we can pick up on that.
Have, like... Whatever the enshrined formula for the amount a rent can be raised before there's a cap is, it's anything above the consumer price index, it's like most people do not receive a raise that is equal to the consumer price index anymore. Most people in America are working at service jobs that are underpaid, and I'm sure Oregon is a poor state. Overall, so it always was anyway. So, you know, they're basing it on some middle class value, upper middle class, wealthy. Really, there's not really much middle class left, you know. So they're basing it on some values that aren't relative to what people are actually earning.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you know, have you had any contact with any of these organizations up in Oregon who I presume to some extent are fighting the same fight you and others are in California?
No, but, I mean, the way it goes is, you know, things aren't perfect at the beginning. So, I'm sure that, you know, people are happy that there's, you know, somebody wanted to pass rent control in Oregon. It's just a nod in the direction of tenants. You know, it's like throwing a crumb. And this is what happened in San Francisco. When it originally passed rent control, it was a weak law. And then over time, you know, they passed things at the ballot that strengthened it. Some things were overturned, but most things stuck. So the law became stronger. As that law became stronger and then new rent control initiatives were passed in other cities, they could start at a higher floor because San Francisco or whatever cities, Berkeley, you know, the early ones, had already gone through court challenges. And so, you know, that's how it worked in California, where, you know, there probably is more rent control here than anywhere except New York. And so, you know, even if it's kind of a weak law, it's still a good thing because you're setting on a path to where that's an accepted thing. Because it's hard to get anybody who owns property to vote in favor of rent control, frankly. They have to really understand what's going on and that it's not going to hurt them. And, you know, there's a difference between a property owner and a landlord. Only 7% of Americans are landlords. Most people are just homeowners, you know. So depending on where you live, there could be a higher concentration of landlords, whatever. But basically it's, you know, the figure by HUD is 7% of Americans are landlords. So maybe the homeowners that have adult children that are no longer able to afford the rent are now in Congress.
Indeed.
And have more understanding of the needs of the younger generations that are not making as much as their parents did.
Now jumping back to Santa Cruz, Cynthia, because that's where you've done most of your work, and actually that's where you know many of us live, or at least in the surrounding area. The city council, of course, though it acquired a rent control just eviction protection majority, chose not to try to do the second reading of their ordinance. And we've talked about this online, on you know, on the air before, as to your the fears that there would be a recall and the money would essentially dump them out.
It's just a reality.
Well, no, it's not a reality for me until it happens.
It's a reality.
But, you know, it certainly is a possibility. And so I guess the question I have is, and you mentioned that you know, people who get evictions don't necessarily rush to the phone to call you up and tell you about it. And so you're not the center of information for all this. But have you heard anything more about, you know, whether there has been increased or continuing or particularly noteworthy eviction presages, the eviction activity.
I haven't heard of any mass evictions recently in Santa Cruz.
That's good.
I don't, you know, there's nobody hears about these things unless they're just lucky, because there's no clearinghouse for this kind of information.
So there wasn't.
I haven't heard of anything. But you know, tenants call me for all kinds of reasons, but I haven't been called about a mass eviction. You might want to start interviewing Zoff. He Hirschfield. He's working with Students United with Renters. They have a little hotline too. I don't think it's called that often because it just mine's been around 5 years. It just is more better known, more widely disseminated.
Have you gotten any of their other?
You know, he might.
Have you gotten to any of their meetings recently? I haven't ever been to one of their meetings, but
I just went to a meeting because to offer them some resources recently, but I didn't stay for the meeting. I just came and spoke for 5 minutes or 10 minutes.
I know another thing that you've been concerned with, and you've come to Huff meetings occasionally to talk about and to be available for, is recognizing that there's a sort of a joint front with folks who are in their vehicles, folks who are outside, and folks who are renters facing those who are essentially property owners in terms of survival needs around housing. And you talked to me about this a couple days ago about your suggestions for a sort of a buddy system for people who, and actually we've talked about this at the Huff meetings too, for those who are threatened with harassment at night or during the day for their RV residence.
Well, I think it would be, it's a good idea to have somebody you can call so somebody can actually be on the line listening also. You know, if you're afraid, they can hear the person banging on, like if there's a cop, someone banging on your RV, you can call someone and then you can just have the phone on so they can hear it, for one thing, so they're witnessing it. You know, they could also be recording it, for all you know. I mean, you know, hopefully some people can record stuff easily. But, yeah, I mean, or you could just say, oh, my God, somebody just banged, you know, I'm really scared. Somebody just banged on my, you know, somebody just attacked me or whatever, you know, in my vehicle. So, yeah, I think it would be good, you know, as a part of organizing a little bit for themselves to establish a buddy system. I can't impose things on people. I don't live in my vehicle, but, you know, for those who are organizing, it might be good to try to get a phone list together.
No, I like the idea, too. I'm thinking also the next Santa Cruz City Council meeting has an item on its agenda, which I think you've been talking about. It is, I'm looking for it now, directing the staff to...
What about the task force?
Tenants Legal Services request.
So we think that, you know, there's a group called Tenant Sanctuary, which I helped start, and... it's legal aid because the city cut all legal aid funding. It's just outrageous. And we just need a lot of more people to help us with this stuff. Or, you know, frankly, we're just not going to get anything done if we don't have more volunteers. We need more volunteers. We need people to research how much the city of Santa Cruz has spent on legal aid over the years. It would take somebody, you know, less than a day to find out this data, but they might have to go to the city hall. So if somebody wants to volunteer to do that, they should call the tenant hotline, 831-222-0359. That's 831-222-0359. 1-800-273-5359, and that's the tenant hotline, and, you know, anybody can call it. So, Tenant Sanctuary is a legal aid project for just the city of Santa Cruz. It's going to be extremely underfunded. It's just going to be a pilot. And that's okay because it's kind of a new group. So, I can understand why a city wants to be careful with the taxpayers' money. But the idea is to set up a legal aid that can help anyone who is low income and anyone who is undocumented, because the other legal aid in the county, California Rural Legal Assistance, receives funding through the federal, I forget what it's called, but there's a federal legal aid funding group, and they have limitations. They can't serve undocumented people. They can't represent them. They can consult with them, but they can't actually represent them. So the idea for Tenant Sanctuary, which is why we have sanctuary in the name, my idea is that we can also, when we do get enough money from the city to actually hire a lawyer, then we will be able to represent undocumented people because we won't have limitations.
Now, you were at the last city council meeting, Cynthia. At least I saw you there briefly. It went on and on and on, so I don't know how early you got there.
Yeah, I was there to the end.
Any reaction to anything that happened there that you think might be of interest to low-income folks?
I don't know. I'd have to sit and try to remember it.
Nothing immediately jumps out at you.
I have that kind of memory, mm-hmm. Where I can just, go back to that meeting. I mean, I had a busy week, and a lot of thoughts went through my head. So. Mm-hmm.
Nothing particularly leaps out and says, yow, or anything of that sort.
Well, it might, but I'd have to sit here and think about it.
Okay.
Because, yeah. There's a lot of thoughts in my head, so.
Now this particular
meeting isn't.
Have you had much contact with interns from any of the city council members? I know Drew Glover.
I don't know any of them.
Oh, so nobody has come to you and said, we want some help with tenant work and putting something on the agenda that will help tenants?
Nobody has asked me for that, no.
Uh-huh. Okay. I think they should.
Okay, here's something that I could talk about from the last meeting.
Go ahead.
So, Drew Glover, made a proposal to make a declaration of a state of emergency, a state of homelessness, a state of homelessness emergency or a state of homeless emergency, however you call it. And then he made some proposals about, we should enclose the camp. I don't even remember the rest of it because this is what I focused on this week.
Mm-hmm.
So what did he's proposing something. I don't know what it is. What is a state of emergency? So I looked into it, and I researched it, because they didn't explain what it is. And then Cynthia Matthews said, well, we don't really want to say it's a state of emergency because, it isn't really an emergency because it's been going on for years. And so my thought there was, yeah, you should have declared it an emergency years ago because it's an emergency that's been going on for years for the human beings caught up in it,
mm-hmm.
And so Justin seemed kind of...
Justin Cummings, the other council member.
Justin Cummings. And so Chris Cron and Sandy Brown and Drew voted, to call it a state of emergency, but the other four voted not to call it a state of emergency. Mm-hmm. And so I was just wondering, what is a state of emergency, and was there a particular reason that Drew wanted to call it a state of emergency? So I asked Drew, but he didn't really answer me in detail about it. So I actually found out there's a lot of different kinds of state of emergencies, and one of them is called a local emergency. This is, part of the definition in the United States hierarchy of governments, federal, state, National Guard, local, regional. So you can call a local emergency, and the way it's done is that the elected board, it could be a board of supervisors, it could be a city council, the jurisdictional people in power can call a local emergency, and then there are certain criteria that have to be met. And so what I, and then I just don't get any answer from these people. I think I'm just over their head, or they just, it's not something they want to do, but I'm like, maybe you need to justify the state of emergency, and here is how you do it, and I think it can be done, but I never heard back from any of them, so I'm kind of tired of even talking about this.
And in case you're tiring a bit, too, let's listen to the musical side of things.
Trump sat alone in his golden lair, totally emotionless except for his hair. Money flowed up in an overabundance. He totally confused all the TV pundits. He's drunk, he's drunk, he's in my head.
We have losers, we have losers.
He's drunk, he's drunk, he's drunk, he's in your head.
I think I am a nice person. People that know me like me.
Trump lingered first in all the polls, even though he sounds like a total asshole. Trump said, Mexicans, you need to leave. That is, unless you are working for me. He's Trump, he's Trump, he's in your head.
Our president doesn't have a clue.
He's Trump, he's Trump, he's Trump for president. What? No!
China.
Blah, 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 blah.
I just sold an apartment for $15 million to somebody from China. I'm really rich. A total net worth, well over $10 billion.
Republicans don't want Trump in their club, so Trump crashed the party cause he don't give a fuck. Trump loves America and freedom as well, almost as much as he loves himself. He's Trump, he's Trump, he's in your head. He's Trump, he's Trump, he's Trump, if he wins we're dead. I need this Trump out of my head, I think so. Get this Trump out of my head, I hope so. Got this Trump stuck in my head, I know so. Will the Trump be president? I think no.
Now that was a parody song called Trump, by a group called the Presidents of the United States of America, turned a 90s alt-rock warhouse lump into a parody song called Trump. Some of the words of which you could actually understand. You're tuned to the stream of free radio at freakradio.org, or possibly where it's archived on the Huff Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom website at huffsantacruz.org, where you can find lots of old shows. Back to Cynthia Berger and the Santa Cruz Tenants Association's, well, her thoughts. And she's the mainstay of the Santa Cruz Tenants Association.
Yeah, I mean, you want to say more, or are you giving up here?
No, I'm just like, I feel so ineffectual. You know?
Oh, yeah, well, you know, we all are until somebody starts listening or until we all get together and start shouting, so.
Right.
I know that there were two.
Anyway, so my point was, I asked both Drew and Justin. I asked Justin why he didn't vote for it to be a state of emergency. That, you know, I wasn't like blaming him or anything. I was just asking a simple question, and so, you know, he just said, you know, he thought we should wait before we proclaim it an emergency. And I don't know. Both of the answers were kind of wishy-washy and not really on point to me. And so I'm assuming they just disregarded my point, which was like a state of emergency needs to be, you need to define it. And then, you know, for Drew, the reason I told him that was because I thought, well, maybe if you define it, then Cynthia Matthews won't be able to hold so much sway over the other three people, two of whom don't know Jack because they're just gotten on the council. You know, they obviously don't know very much.
Well, you know, my understanding about this, Cynthia, is that a homeless emergency, and the other is some other kind of emergency.
The shelter emergency.
Right, there you go.
But
let me finish this. What
shelter emergency, but there is not a government-defined homeless emergency. But
I see.
The state of Hawaii and certain cities have gone ahead and proclaimed that as a jurisdictional local emergency. But there are certain kinds of emergencies that are actually, you know, in legislatively defined, you know, by statute, kind of.
Well, as I was saying, my understanding of this was that one of them has to do with state funding, and the other has to do with the ability to suspend local codes. And again, I'm not sure which is which or how clearly those distinctions are maintained, but that's what somebody told me somewhere along the line. Still there? Hello? Cynthia? Oh, I think I lost her. We may try again, but in the meantime... I gave you those two different definitions that I got. Did you get anything like that yourself, or...?
I don't think I heard those. I think your phone kind of...
Oh, well, again, well, one of them is that state and federal funding goes to one kind of emergency, and the other is that local ordinances can be suspended or modified or, you know...
Exactly, right, and so...
Now, are those two different kinds, are those two different emergencies, or is all this...
No, those can be all parts of a state of emergency. They, you can benefit from all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you can have, there's two things you can get immunity from, lawsuits, and you can get waivers of regulations. Mm-hmm. Immunity and waivers are two of the things. I put this on my Facebook page, the whole definition, but I can send it to you. And
now, where can people find that that definition if they want to read it?
On my Facebook page, but they're going to have to scroll down.
And the Facebook page is for...
Is Facebook/Santa Cruz Tenants, all one word.
So it's
Facebook/Santa Cruz Tenants.
So go to Facebook and look for Santa Cruz Tenants.
Yeah.
Okay, good enough.
Yeah, you have to scroll down. I'm always posting things on there, but I posted it like early yesterday, so there's probably maybe a few, 5 or 10 posts.
And so that's a good place to go if you want to follow at least your take on tenant activity.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But, I put local stuff, and then I put other national, regional stuff, too. I probably should have a separate page for local stuff.
Anything you're looking for, not that anything's likely to show up, but at the city council level, you mentioned, I think, a couple of months ago that you would definitely like to see more funding so that there could be some kind of ombudsperson or a tenant assistant.
Yeah, right. So Seattle actually has a renter's commission now, and... I think Santa Cruz needs a renter's commission because the situation is very dire here for renters. You know, so however they want to start it out, I think they need a renter's commission. So they can do that for free because commissions aren't paid, but they really need a paid staff person who is, you know, has a certain amount of power conferred on them in their position. And if there's a renter's commission, there should be some kind of interaction between a renter's commission and a planning commission. That's mm-hmm. really important. And I think there should be a houseless commission as well, you know, if there are people who can be on it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard when you're houseless to do stuff. But
well, Berkeley has a variety of these kinds of conditions, a peace and justice commission, they call it homelessness commission. They are about twice as big as we are, a little bit bigger, but, you know, it's not beyond, I think, beyond belief to do that if we had the will.
Yeah. To the council, so another thing is, so that's, you know, something I can't fight for these things by myself, and it's just hard to find people in Santa Cruz who are willing to work together. There's a lot of balkanization in the activist community, but so it's frustrating. Even the tenant organizers, you know, there aren't really any. They like to think that they are,
mm-hmm.
but they haven't done any. But, you know, people are working on things. Anyway, so another thing that I've been thinking about is, there should be, I think the city should have a paid tenant, and I don't know what you want to call homelessness, a homeless commissioner and a tenant commissioner, and I think there should be a commission, or I don't know what they should be called, a commissioner, I don't think they should be an ombudsperson, but they couldn't pay them enough for the amount of work they'd have to do to be an ombudsperson, but... some kind of, I really think there should just be a tenant services department. or, you know, it could be just a non-property owner services department. I don't know. You could call it tenants and homeless people department. You know, that would be great because it would take the stigma away from homelessness and just put all tenants and homeless people together because we don't own property.
And I think you also have been, you know, lacking the millennium at the moment and having that not necessarily, well, it might happen with this council majority, but I'm thinking you've also suggested that there be a, that people who are in RVs, for instance, because that was what you were working with Huff on for a while, there may still be, for all I know, that there is a possibility of people, and we've said this to folks too, of simply documenting as much as possible when any problems come up, if you're being hounded, harassed, whether it's police, vigilantes, I don't know. And I think at one point you and others offered to be a clearinghouse where people could call in, at least mention these things.
Nobody's called in. And however many times you've mentioned on your show or it's been on the internet, not one person has called in. So that's useless. So you have to go door to door. You have to canvass.
Uh-huh.
Nobody wants to do that, except maybe me and Alicia when we find the time.
And again, the phone number, if anybody does
it's
decide to call.
831-222-0359. 831-222-0359.
Yeah, not expecting a rush of calls, but I always think it's helpful to put it out anyway, so I do. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, people probably go like, why would I call? You know, but it's like, and in a way that's true, because I'm not going to be collecting a lot of data from phone calls. It's just not how you collect data. It's not going to work. So the fact of the matter is the city needs to pay professionals to collect data. Because it costs money to do that kind of work. It's not like a volunteer kind of fun job. You know, it's hard work and it's time consuming. And there's no point doing it if it's not good data either. You know, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay, good. I just was reading it. I put my phone number out there, but nobody ever calls me. People just call me when they're looking for tenants, rights hotline.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I understand.
Get other calls, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. We tried it. You know, it was an experiment, but it didn't really work. But people are always welcome to call me and get, at least put them in touch with other folks or tell them where meetings are.
Well, before we're both terminally depressed, I'm gonna try to wind it up, but give you a chance to add anything you want to before we sink into our own.
Okay, yeah. Here's something I do want to talk about, and that is okay. There's stuff going on. There are groups meeting about community land trust and public ownership of land. They're kind of, you know, baby steps here, but there's some good people on these committees who I think will work hard. And so if people are interested in those, they could call the hotline, 831-222-0359. Community land trust, we're just trying to understand, you know, how it works. It costs money to buy land, so that's going to be the main stumbling block.
Mm.
Then there are other groups that are doing anti-gentrification, and they're kind of rewriting some of the laws, and they're, you know, they're not really that knowledgeable about writing laws, but I think it's great, and they're, like, for example, laws about housing, you know, they're changing market rate units when the Planning Commission is looking at developments, and they're calling them luxury units. You know, and so basically we have either luxury units or affordable units in the Santa Cruz, you know, and so that was kind of a great idea. I mean,
more accurate anyway.
But the other thing is, like, the Planning Commission is what is in charge of gentrifying Santa Cruz. And they're supposed to work for the city council. So a commission reports to a city council. The commission doesn't have any power as far as they aren't voted in. They're only appointed. So the city council has to approve what they say. So in the past, the city council has rubber-stamped most of what the Planning Commission told them. And now that we have a progressive majority, nobody's looking at this because a lot of people are new to this stuff. But we need to challenge the power of the Planning Commission and the staff who serve the Planning Commission, because they continually approve housing because they're trying to get rid of poor people. So they continually only approve housing that poor people can never live in, making more people here homeless, and then they're so surprised at the city about, oh, we have so many homeless people, and, oh, we have so many drug addicts, you know, and we do. We have huge amounts of drug addicts compared to other cities and huge amounts of homeless people compared to other cities, ratio-wise. So, you know, they just refuse to put that together with the fact that people can't afford housing and have very low wages. You know, they just won't attack that,
mm-hmm.
you know, that duo there. I am talking to some new planning commissioners, you know, that are more progressive possibly, and I am asking them why developers do community meetings with neighbors, and then the developers just have the architect go. Well, the architect doesn't know how much the rents are going to be, and they're not supposed to have to tell people how much the rents are going to be. But the consumers in Santa Cruz are the renters. They're not the people who buy it, but they're actually building they want to build a huge development of over 300 units, and then they want to sell each one of those as a condominium to an owner who will then rent it out. So they're making an investment property for people to make money off of renters. So renters are the actual consumers. And as consumers, we don't have a right in Santa Cruz to ask at a neighborhood meeting how much those units are going to rent for. They don't have to answer that. So I am trying to correct that, and it may be a legal thing where they don't have to answer it. So I'm saying the city can make a rule that the staff has to estimate that before anything can be approved. The staff has to make an estimate based on, you know, local rents and past developments and the difference between what, you know, what it. Anyway, the staff needs to figure out a formula to predict what the rents are going to be before these things are approved.
Sounds promising.
You know, so that it's not illegal, it's just an opinion. You know, and it's like we should have freedom of speech and be able to give an opinion on about how much the rents might be. But I don't like that they're approving projects that nobody can afford. So that
and doing it blind, actually.
Make money off of renters.
And doing it blind.
Consumer.
And doing it blind as a point. So you can't tell before it happens what's going on. Well, listen, I'm gonna.
Yeah. And then also, that shouldn't be that. That shouldn't be market rate housing. There should be a moratorium. Oh, here's another thing. There should be a moratorium on market rate housing for at least 2 years. And no housing should be built unless it's affordable housing. It's either nothing or affordable.
And affordable, you would define how?
Well, affordable has to be, you know, defined by the people who need to rent it.
Do you have a definition you're offering?
Well, put it this way. So there's these federal categories. There's extremely low, very low, and low income. Probably most, at least half, or maybe more than half of the city of Santa Cruz falls into the low-income category, even if 10 years ago they would have been considered middle class, and not including teachers. Like, the first, like, seven salary steps of teachers at Santa Cruz City Schools, they're all in the low-income category. They're not in the middle-income category. And so the city has a huge deficit since it's only, you know, when there was a redevelopment agency, which Governor Brown, I think, was who closed it. They had a little more money for affordable housing. It was never their main priority, but they did build more affordable housing because it's hyper expensive, and they would get some help, some money to help put towards it. Now the Governor Brown apparently hated renters, so he shut the redevelopment agencies, and so hardly any low income housing is being built. So therefore. But also, there's a historical deficit of housing for low-income people in the city of Santa Cruz. And that's because, for a lot of reasons, it's complicated. It's not like something to say in 5 minutes. But, you know, over the years, there were environmentalists who were county supervisors and city council members, and they wanted to keep the place nice, you know, but this also pushed their own property values up. They wanted to keep the population from getting too big, blah, blah, blah. Impossible stuff. It's not Soviet Russia or China. You know, it's the United States. So when people want to come here, then they come here. And plus, you have a University of California, which is impossible for the city to modify. And so they'll just pile people in here. They don't give a darn. And, they don't really care about their students having a huge debt either, really. So they'll shovel them all full of debt. You know, they call it financial aid, and they pile debt on the students in order to come to school here. Oh, well, they have a higher financial aid threshold. We give them more incentive, or they can go into more debt here because the housing's so expensive, you know. So, I mean, it's a complicated thing, but the housing needs to be understood by the renters, and they're kind of bored with it. They're kind of not interested, and they need to get interested in it.
Well, you've interested me, but I'm going to kind of leave it there, give you the last word, though.
Well, I think people need to get involved. A lot more people need to get involved. If they want their lives to improve, they need to get involved. They need to be much more politically active now, because the power is just all against, it's against them. The power is arrayed against people. I understand some people don't ever want to have to think about this stuff, but for those of you, you know, who are aware of it, you can make a difference by electing people and then pressuring those people in case they might want to stay in office, you know.
And if people want to learn more about this, they can go to your Facebook page at?
Yeah, it's Facebook.com/Santa Cruz Tenants.
Thank you, Cynthia. And we'll just leave it there.
Well, thank you, Robert, for doing this show and being, you know, I thought you spoke really great at the city council last week.
Yeah, thank you.
You did a good job.
Well, you know.
I didn't forget what you said, but I was really...
You liked it when it happened. Thank you, Cynthia.
All right, Robert, take care.
Bye-bye.
And that's about it for the contemporary current Bathurst Bears Broadsides reports. We're now going to jump back to April 15th, 2015 for a flashback on part of a Sunday show. If you want to hear the whole Sunday show, you can by going to the Huff website and looking up April 15th, 2015, where you'll find the older complete show. I don't have the time or room to play it, but I've selected parts from it that might be of interest. The principally what you'll be listening to now has to do with the deforestation activities of the UCSC authorities up in Berkeley going after People's Park, which they're again doing or have been doing recently even more intensely as part of what appears to be a drive to essentially destroy the community-operated park and turn it into a essentially subsidiary of the UCSC megalith out there. It's being resisted by the community, but as you heard from activist Mike Zint, that, in his opinion, isn't likely to be successful. I don't know. I haven't yet actually talked to any of the park's defenders. Maybe I will in the next week. You're also going to hear just a lot of kind of contemporary street reports from 2015. And so happy listening, and get back in touch if you've seen stuff on the streets you want to pass on to the rest of the community, if you have events you want to announce that are coming up, if you have some criticism or additions to what you've heard on the air, or if you'd like to get involved with civil rights movements for poor people outside, give a call to 423-4833. That's 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, which is an acronym for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group that meets every week at noon up the Sub Rosa Cafe at 703 Pacific, and its sister organization, Conscience in Action, meets at 11, an hour before. Both of them are open to the public. Invite you to come on down and join us. Thanks for listening.